Hi, I'm Bill Thomas, and this is Prairie Public Presents, an hour a week for special programs. Criminal justice reform can mean a lot of things. Locking more people up, locking less people up, building more prisons, starting more programs. A year ago, Meg Luther Lindholm approached us here at Prairie Public saying that the discussion in North Dakota was heating up and the legislature was going to be looking at some action. There were a lot of reasons, not least of which was the hugely rising cost of prisons. There were also a lot of ideas about how to relieve the problems. Meg wanted to report on this, so we worked with her to get support from the North Dakota Humanities Council, and she did up a series of reports that she called Journeys Through Justice. Today, Meg is here. We're going to recap most of those reports and talk about what is happening now with some of the proposals. As she was working, public perceptions of the problems changed, and Meg, did you feel like kind of a rising interest in this topic as you were working on it?
Definitely as I was working on it. When I was first conceiving the idea back last fall in preparation to get funding to do the project, I wasn't really getting a sense that it was much on the radar of the general public. Certainly the opioid crisis, certainly the fact that there have been so many overdose deaths. That was very much front and center in public awareness and continues to be, and rightly so. But at the time, there wasn't as much attention being paid to the prison overcrowding issue. But when I started to look into it, I realized that so many of the people in prison, an estimated close to 75% of people in prisons in North Dakota were there because of a drug-related crime. And clearly the prisons cost a lot of money to the taxpayers, and legislators on both sides of the aisle were concerned. And so as the legislative session got underway, the topic started to become more of interest, certainly to legislators, but also increasingly to the general public.
And the first piece we're going to hear today is sort of a case study.
Right. I wanted to start the series by really looking at the problem of prison overcrowding, who's going to prison, through the lens of one woman's story, a young woman named Carly Cochain. She's is or was in prison, had been incarcerated twice for her addiction to heroin. And I interviewed her parents about what her experience, both with drug addiction and the prison system, was like.
Okay, let's hear it.
A large majority of the people serving time in the state's prisons and jails are addicted to drugs and/or alcohol. Many also suffer from mental health problems. There's bipartisan agreement that the cost and the number of people cycling in and out of the system are both way too high. So the question is how to keep people out of the system and reduce the number of people in the system. It's a hard nut to crack, given the difficulties involved in treating addiction. Carly Cochain is a case in point. She has cycled in and out of both treatment and prison for her addiction to drugs. Her parents, Wendy and Ray Cochain, have tried to help Carly since she first started using drugs as a teenager.
She was like 14, probably when she started smoking pot. She was in middle school. Self-esteem, I think she had some issues with that. And she got hooked up with people that made her feel good about herself in the wrong way. You know,
in college, Carly began hanging out with people who got her hooked on heroin.
And the whole world seemed to crash down. It was like a parent's worst nightmare to find that and to see it.
Carly tried to kick her habit in a variety of treatment programs, but she always returned to using. One thing to note is that Wendy and Ray, who are Carly's parents, have resources to help her. They live in a lovely home in one of Fargo's most affluent neighborhoods. The point being that drug addiction can affect anyone, regardless of class, race, or ethnicity. And even with money, treating addiction can be incredibly difficult. Denial is a hard wall to knock down.
Denial is someone not seeing the reality of their life.
Brenda Ross Phillips is a licensed addiction counselor at Prairie St. John's in Fargo.
And of course, some people will just flat say, my life is fine. I'm doing fine. And I'll say, really? So you've got charges, you don't have a job, you're couch surfing, and you think your life is fine? Oh, yes. They aren't seeing what's happening.
Eventually, Carly was arrested for selling a narcotic drug to an undercover officer. By that time, her parents were frantically worried about her. Her father, Ray, says it was actually a relief when she was convicted and sent to prison.
It was helpful in that it broke the cycle of her being around her particular group of using friends, and she was safe, and she wasn't using.
Carly did spend 3 months in a prison drug treatment program. But the shock of returning home after 2 years in prison pretty much negated the benefit she got from the treatment.
Getting out there and being responsible for yourself and making bringing in an income and trying to get a place to live, she's a felon, that is going to be a struggle.
According to the National Institute of Justice, over 70% of drug offenders who serve time end up being rearrested. A majority of these new arrests happen within the first year of release. Within a very short time after her release from prison, Carly was back on heroin. Only this time, she was pregnant. And then she overdosed. A friend called 911, Narcan was administered, and Carly and her baby were saved. The next day, a police officer showed up at the family home, and she was taken back to prison, in part for the safety of the baby. She's still in prison, waiting for the birth of her child and for her release.
She deals with depression and the stress, the anxiety that she feels. And now she's going to have a baby, and she knows that what's expected more of her. Is she able to do that? My husband and I just talked last night. We hope, but we don't know. We don't know if she's going to be able to handle it all. It's going to be a long road.
State legislators are looking at ways to reduce the number of inmates in North Dakota's prisons, especially like Carly, whose crime is their addiction to drugs. The question is, what programs or policies can help substance abusers avoid the cycle of incarceration?
Well, Carly is an example of the problem that our legislature in North Dakota and many people around the country are wrestling with. And who did you talk to about that?
So I talked to a great number of people about that. And one of the people I interviewed was the director of the correction system, Leanne Birch. And she really talked about how the prisons have come to be so overcrowded, that there are so few services and treatment programs for substance abusers, that what often happens or has happened in the past is that judges will sentence people to prison simply because prison is a place that offers treatment. It takes people out of their environments and gets them sober and gets them treatment. So the prisons have become a revolving door in a way for a lot of people whose crimes are fueled by drug addiction.
All right.
Since taking the job as the state's director of corrections in 2005, Leanne Birch has seen a dramatic rise in the state's prison population.
Yes, we are the third fastest growing state in terms of incarceration, which is not a great statistic to have.
The growth is driven largely by people who are addicted to drugs and alcohol.
I would say about 75% of all of the individuals being incarcerated at the state penitentiary and our other prisons around the state have a fairly significant drug or alcohol addiction.
When Birch first began as the state's top corrections officer, the national trend was towards stiffer penalties and longer prison terms for drug crimes. But Birch doesn't think these approaches have worked.
They increase incarceration, but at some point when you over-incarcerate, the return on investment is not there.
The state's more recent opioid crisis has also led to a spike in incarceration.
We have parents who are so scared about their loved one overdosing on heroin or prescription drugs or fentanyl that they will beg our probation officers to send people to prison because they think their loved one will be safer locked up versus continuing to use in the community.
A survey of judges around the state confirmed what Director Birch said she had already long suspected, that incarceration is being used as a way to get drug offenders into treatment.
70% of the judges indicated that they have sentenced low-risk, nonviolent individuals to the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation just to access treatment. So oftentimes, people with drug addictions are criminalized in order to receive treatment in a correctional facility. So I really think that jails and prisons have become a default answer to a problem that's very complex but has better solutions than incarceration.
But treating addiction outside of prison means increasing services that are in very short supply, especially in small towns, like addiction counselors. This doesn't have to mean spending an arm and a leg, Birch says. She recommends hiring more peer counselors and expanding the use of teleconferencing, which is one way offenders in prison connect with counselors.
So we might have a psychiatric nurse practitioner sitting in Jamestown, but she's actually, through the computer, providing those behavioral health services to some of our women out in New England in the women's prison. So we are absolutely providing services across our system from someone that might be 200 miles away. And I think that model could really expand services to our rural areas in a cost-effective and efficient manner.
Birch also wants an expansion of Medicaid to help more offenders pay for drug treatment and more transportation to help offenders get to drug treatment programs in the state's larger cities. She says that funding services to help offenders outside of prison will save the state money in the long run.
Prison is often the most expensive option, and research shows community-based options to be more effective and less expensive. But right now, the community-based options are slim.
We're listening to segments from Journeys Through Justice, and I should mention that we're grateful that the North Dakota Humanities Council supported this project. Well, Megan, that produced piece, you were just talking to Leanne Birch, Director of Corrections for North Dakota, but the legislature sets the laws, the context within which all of this happens, and you did get a chance to talk to some legislators.
Right. So I wanted to speak to both a Democrat and a Republican, two people very involved with dealing with these issues. And the two people who came in the studio with me were Senator Judy Lee and Representative Kathy Hogan. And we sat down for a conversation about why they think the drug epidemic has become so pervasive throughout the state, and some of their ideas for what could be done to treat offenders outside of the prisons. You probably know that drug addiction has been a growing problem in North Dakota. Meth has made a steady comeback in the last few years. And the most recent survey from the Centers for Disease Control shows that the state ranks first in the nation for self-identified binge drinkers. And opioid addiction has skyrocketed. Altogether, these different substances are taking a toll on human lives and in the number of people serving time in the state's prisons and jails.
There isn't a county that hasn't got a problem with this, and everybody knows it.
That's Senator Judy Lee, who chairs the Senate's Human Services Committee. She's working to reduce the twin problems of drug addiction and incarceration with legislators on both sides of the aisle. Like Representative Kathy Hogan, who's been working on issues of addiction for years. She says opioid addiction grew in part from a question about pain that doctors now routinely ask their patients.
Now, if you go to the doctor, they'll ask you, what's your rate of pain, even if you're not talking about a pain issue. And adding that consciousness raised everyone's first expectation that we'll never have pain, and we're always going to have pain. And secondly, it forces the doctor, if there is pain, to do something.
Which in many cases is a good thing, says Senator Judy Lee.
If you have bone cancer, you want that OxyContin.
Yeah.
I want you to have it. I want it.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, today my knee hurts. I want it.
But when that became a vital sign, that was part of the changing of the culture.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Everybody expecting that, oh, I can get medication to relieve this.
Exactly.
Yeah. If everybody were good, we wouldn't have this problem, but it doesn't matter what the issue is. There's somebody who's going to game the system one way or another.
Well, and addiction is a disease, and once you're hooked, it's so hard to get off and to understand that It's not a choice. It's really out of your control. And having enough treatment and support services, which we don't have at this point, makes a difference.
The shortage of treatment services has led to a spike in incarceration, which Senator Lee says is causing a huge strain on the correction system.
Right now, if every county jail and the penitentiary complete the additions to their facilities that they have either already started or have planned, we'll be increasing the number of beds by 48%.
And there are some other concerning numbers, like the $40,000 price tag per prisoner per year, and the $64 million price tag for the newly expanded state prison in Bismarck that is already full, and the fact that North Dakota's rate of incarceration is one of the fastest growing in the country. Hogan says these numbers have elicited a bipartisan response.
The behavioral health crisis is recognized in both houses and by both parties pretty unanimously as a crisis in North Dakota. They've been touched by their family members, by their local stakeholders. We have a crisis and we own it. I think we will find joint solutions, many of them that won't cost significant dollars.
Like transferring money from more prison beds to more community services.
So that they could get daily treatment, they could get housing support, they could get assistance with jobs, and they would be held accountable. It could include 24/7 monitoring and very intense intervention to prevent jail and incarceration. And what we know is that this is cheaper, it's more humane, and in the long run, it will work.
Other ideas include expanding a voucher program to help low-income offenders pay for treatment, and expanding telehealth, which allows people to connect with counselors on their tablets or phones, which Senator Lee says has its advantages.
So if I can sit at home in my pajamas at my kitchen table with my iPhone, I feel like I'm having a private conversation about the challenges I'm facing. So we're hopeful it's going to be one tool in our toolbox.
And Senator Lee says there's always room for more ideas at the legislative table.
And the citizens should be talking to their legislators about their concerns in this too, so they know that the public supports these kinds of efforts too.
So there are a lot of different ideas about how to help with the problem that Attorneys for Justice is addressing, and you talk about one of them in this next piece.
Right. So what really came to the forefront of legislative meetings that happened prior to the start of the actual session was an idea called justice reinvestment. This is really an idea that has been implemented in many states around the country and will now be implemented here in North Dakota as a result of passage by the legislature, essentially, of justice reinvestment. And very simply, what it means is you take dollars that you would allocate to future spending on more prison beds, and you reinvest those dollars into programs in communities so that drug offenders, instead of going to prison while they're still in the criminal justice system, they'll be serving their time outside of prison. So that means many more drug offenders going into the probation system, and from within the probation system getting a whole array of services to deal with their addiction, to find them housing, jobs, etc., sort of a comprehensive plan for trying to keep them out of the prison system. Here's a simple fact. The number of people in North Dakota's prisons and jails is growing at a faster rate than in almost every other state in the country. Many prisoners in North Dakota are serving time for drug-related crimes, and many end up back in the system within a year of their release. A year ago, legislators and others with a vested interest in fixing these problems began meeting to draft bills for the current legislative session. For guidance, they called on Mark Pelka. He's with the Council on State Government's Justice Center. Pelka has worked with 25 other states facing the same problems as North Dakota.
So from the very beginning, the goal was for the state, with our assistance, to identify ways to bend that curve, to avoid contract bed use, and identify savings that can be plowed into strategies to reduce recidivism.
In other words, take money that would be spent on more prison beds and invest that money in supervised programs in communities. So instead of going to prison, a drug offender might be sentenced to probation with mandatory drug treatment. Because research shows that many drug offenders who go to prison end up back to their old ways soon after getting out.
And when they're inside the walls of a prison, they're interacting with people who have more extensive criminal records, have a greater risk, and whatever benefit might be achieved from positive programming behind the walls is probably made worse by the experience of being in prison.
But here's the rub. The probation system is already overcrowded. It's questionable whether placing more, potentially higher-level drug offenders on probation will stop the cycle of incarceration. Hi. Are you Heidi?
I'm Heidi.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well. I'm ready.
You ready?
I just want to jump in.
Heidi Arnhold is a dedicated probation officer with 16 years of experience in North Dakota alone. She's also the only probation officer in the southeastern part of the state. I recently joined her on her rounds as she met with offenders in their homes, at work, or in the front seat of her car. After a while, I realized she spends a lot of time just driving.
I have an individual that's in like my southeast corner of Richland County, and then I have somebody in the northwest corner of Ransom County, so that can be almost 2 hours of drive time.
Heidi's caseload has doubled in the last few years, from 40 to now 80 people, which doesn't give her much time with anyone, including offenders at high risk of ending up back in prison. She's taken to texting as a way to keep tabs on her caseload.
Texting to communicate so that they realize that they need to be accountable and be where they need to be when I need them to be there is important. It allows me to maintain more of a relationship in a certain context because I know more of their activities of what's happening in their life than just checking in once a month.
The shortage of probation and parole officers like Heidi is one problem. But another problem is a shortage of addiction counselors. 80% of Heidi's clients are required to be in drug treatment. But there's only one licensed addiction counselor in her whole area who accepts Medicaid, which is what most offenders rely on. Fargo offers more treatment options, but that's not always an easy trip for people who work and have families.
Okay. And mostly morning shifts for you?
No, just three mornings a week.
I'm with Heidi now on her third appointment of the day, with Heather, who is one of Heidi's success stories.
Better for then you keep Ellie here and get her to school in the morning.
And then my mom will pick her up, and then I just go to my mom's when we're done.
She's currently on parole from prison. She's working, and she's determined to stay off drugs and get both her kids back.
Wonderful. He got a 49 out of 50 out of his hunter safety test.
Because she's doing so well, she doesn't need the intensive level of counseling that many of Heidi's clients need. But Heidi asks Heather how challenging it would be if she did have to go to Fargo for more intensive treatment.
So if you were going to go do an hour session in Fargo, so driving to Fargo a little over an hour from here?
Yeah.
So you got 2.5 hours drive time, an hour counseling time, so almost a half a day of work missed just to go do your 1 hour of treatment or support that's critical to your sobriety.
Yes.
But it would cost you a half a day of work.
Yeah.
And you would be reliant upon your employer allowing you to do that.
Yes.
What would have that done to you?
Mean just to drive? I still would have done it.
Financially, what would it do to you?
Kind of put a damper on things. You know, I can charge at Gas Plus. You know, I can charge things and I charge my gas. But that might have put a damper on things.
The shortage of probation officers and drug treatment programs isn't news to Mark Pelka. Remember, he's the one advising legislators on how to reduce the size and cost of the state's prison population. He says the only way to do that, while also ensuring public safety, is to invest the savings from prison into more probation and drug treatment.
Well, justice reinvestment as an idea did work out, and the North Dakota legislature passed it, and it's still not totally taken shape yet. There was an article that got published around the state originally from the Bismarck Tribune by Carolyn Gruskin about talking to several county sheriffs who were a little concerned about pressure this was going to put on them. And in fact, you've heard about a process that's trying to set it up, right?
Yes. Yeah. So the state legislature did allocate $7 million for expanded programs to assist drug offenders who will now presumably many more of whom will be on probation instead of in prison with kind of a comprehensive range of services from drug treatment to employment assistance and housing assistance. And this is all very much currently in the works. Pam Sagnes, who's the head of the Human Services Department, will be holding hearings, has just started holding hearings around the state to get input from stakeholders on what this kind of comprehensive plan will look like, how it will take shape. But, right, there's concern from people connected to the county jails that, you know, with all these people on probation, you know, some will violate and end up being sanctioned with going to jail. And then how will the jails cope with those people? There might be people who will be sentenced to jail instead of prison. So there are concerns. Plus, you know, there is such a thin infrastructure now of treatment services for people with drug addictions. It's going to have to be built up quite a bit to really address the needs. Drug addiction is a really, really tough nut to crack for a lot of people. So it's going to take a lot of work on the part of lots of people.
Well, you produced several pieces as part of the Journeys Through Justice series. I'm talking to Meg Luther Lindholm. I'm Bill Thomas here at Prairie Public. And Meg produced, as I said, several pieces addressing some of the different ways that people are looking at trying to help with this problem.
Right. And so one of the things that came out of my interview with Leanne Birch that was really interesting was her trip to Norway to visit the prison there, a prison there. She also went to Germany and visited a prison there. And she took away some real interesting lessons in terms of how the prison systems in those two countries, Norway and Germany, are doing much more to try to give those who are incarcerated kind of more of a real life, real world experience from within the prison to then make transitioning back into the real world that much easier. And their recidivism rates have been far lower than ours here. So they're doing much more with sort of work training, and they're trying to create a system whereby, at least in Norway, the prisoners and the guards develop closer, stronger, better relationships with each other. There's sort of a whole social conditioning piece that goes into incarceration there that she is interested in seeing implemented here in North Dakota.
Let's hear about that.
Leanne Birch has a job that most people would not envy. As the state's director of corrections and rehabilitation, she oversees the state's prisons. And since taking the job in 2005, she's also had to oversee a rapid rise in the state's prison population.
We are the third fastest growing state in terms of incarceration, which is not a great statistic to have.
Many people in prison are there because of crimes caused by their addictions to drugs and alcohol. And almost 40% of these offenders become repeat offenders, often within a year of their release. Frustrated, Birch began studying prison systems in other countries, like Norway, which used to have a prison system very much like North Dakota's.
They had a growing prison population. They were having very high recidivism rates. They started having a lot of violence in their prison. We aren't to the point where we were having a lot of violence, but we're seeing more violence.
Norway's prison officials decided to change course, away from a focus on punishment. The idea was to create a world inside prison that would help offenders succeed in the real world outside of prison.
And they said, the less difference the prison is from the outside, the easier it will be for someone to transition from prison to the community. So they want people working, they want people going to school, they want people to be making decisions, they wear their own clothes, they cook some of their own meals, they absolutely basically try to make it as normal as possible. And yet they're very cognizant of security.
But security isn't just about fences and barbed wire. The prison staff work to foster respect with the prisoners as a way to model better behavior. Again, the focus is on trying to give prisoners skills to function better when they leave. And yes, the recidivism rate in Norway is much lower than in North Dakota.
North Dakota's recidivism rate in out of our prison system is right around 39%. It's not the highest, but it's certainly not the lowest. So their recidivism rate runs in anywhere in between to 16 to 20%, which is very enviable.
Another prison system that Director Birch says North Dakota could learn from is in Germany, where the focus is on job training.
They think if you're productively employed and learning a trade, everyone works in that system, that you're less likely to come out and not have a skill and less likely to come out and go back to your criminal enterprise.
She thinks the same type of job training is needed in North Dakota.
We have a lot of downtime in our prison system. We'd love to have everyone employed, but if you could really put some resources and give them a skill that actually lets them live a decent life, not like minimum wage. They need a skill where they can make a decent living, a sustainable wage.
But first, she says, prison administrators have to find out more about the needs of the job market.
I think one of the things we could be more successful in is to really work with commerce, the workforce, to say, what are those jobs that are open in North Dakota and what are the skill sets those individuals need? And we have a population that if we could bring those skill sets to them so that they could fill some of those open positions in North Dakota, I think that would be a very valuable win for North Dakota and our criminal justice system.
Well, we've just heard about one alternative way to organize a prison or approach prisoners, but you looked at other alternatives.
Well, I looked at one other alternative specifically, and that alternative is in our next-door neighbor, Minnesota. They have a program there for drug offenders who are sentenced to prison, and some of these are very hardcore drug offenders, people who've been addicted for a long time. The example in this story is on a woman named Janine Guffey, who was addicted to meth for many years and ended up being incarcerated or sent to this challenge incarceration program in Minnesota.
Drug addiction can be tenacious and very hard to overcome. Severe addicts often need long-term residential treatment away from people who might tempt them back into using. But this kind of long-term treatment is very expensive. It's beyond what many users can afford to pay. So sometimes prison becomes the default option. In fact, 70% of judges in North Dakota have admitted to sentencing addicts to prison in order to get the long-term treatment they need. But prison is also expensive. And when offenders are released, it's often very hard for them to restart their lives.
I think that we have to build alternatives for people who are really being sent to prison and jail because of addiction issues.
That's Leanne Birch, the head of North Dakota's Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. She says there's a need for more programs that offer intensive drug treatment for people like Janine Guffey. Janine was in the grip of meth addiction for years. Her addiction led to her arrest, then jail, and finally to prison in Minnesota. She says prison shouldn't be the place to go for drug treatment. But this was a different kind of treatment program, one that could be a model for helping people kick their addictions outside of prison. And in Janine's case, it worked.
It's called the Challenge Incarceration Program.
The Challenge Incarceration Program is run by the Minnesota Department of Corrections. It's got the feel of military boot camp. Discipline and obedience to rules are rigorously enforced. Behavior is shaped by the demands of the commanding officers, like marching in unison and standing at attention.
They call that military bearing. Military bearing, a way to carry yourself, having that regimented discipline to discipline yourself in all aspects of your life.
Besides the military discipline, the program also has the flavor of Outward Bound. The men's and women's camps are in separate parts of the state, but everyone lives in barracks out in nature.
We were out in the woods, and we had the opportunity to hike and fish and canoe and do chemical dependency treatment.
There's also art therapy, occupational therapy, and behavioral therapy. There's preparation for life and work after prison, and inmates do 6 months of community service as part of their sentence. The program challenges both the body and the mind.
The biological, the psychological, the social, the spiritual aspects of a person, each need attention.
And she says that despite their harsh approach, the staff understands the ravages of addiction and the time that it takes to rebuild one's life.
When somebody's been hard on their body and using drugs or drinking and not eating the right nutrition and not getting the right sleep, and they're deprived and their brain isn't working right and their organs aren't working right, sometimes I think that that's why the justice system, for me, it gave me a chance to heal.
Janine credits challenge incarceration with her recovery, but she says people shouldn't have to go to prison for drug treatment. Her goal now is to help people get into treatment before they wind up in prison.
You think you got what it takes? You think you got what it takes? You think you made mistakes?
Again, this is Prairie Public Presents. I'm Bill Thomas, and I'm sitting with Meg Luther Lindholm, who produced a series that originally aired last spring, but the stories are still very relevant and interesting about alternative ways of approaching issues in the justice system to help for better outcomes for the prisoners. And one thing that maybe helped get a lot of legislators' attention was lower costs overall, because prison costs were getting to be so much higher than they had been in the past. And we've heard about some different alternatives in that last one about a challenge, kind of a boot camp program, but that's not the only way people are addressing the problem.
Right. So this next story focuses on a program that really is the brainchild of one man named Adam Martin. He's created a project called F5. F5 stands for the key on a computer that kind of erases data. And 5 also is the number of felonies that he was arrested for and did time for. So he is someone who comes from inside the system. He really knows what the system is like. He knows how hard it is when you get out to start your life over. And so his whole mission right now is to help offenders, once they're released from the jails in particular, to be able to have the mentoring from people like himself to really get going with their lives again, because this is where recidivism often happens. A lot of people who repeat offend do so within the first year after their release. They have a hard time getting housing. Landlords don't want to rent to them. They have a hard time getting jobs because of the background check that shows that they've done time. And so really, this is one of the hardest hurdles for people coming out of the system to overcome. So Adam is really determined not just to go into the prisons himself and speak to the prisoners about this program and how he wants to help them. And when I say prisoners, I mean really offenders, people in the jails and prisons. But he also brings in employers who are willing to hire people coming out of jail and prison, and to give the people inside hope for themselves when they get out.
Serving time for a crime in prison or jail is arduous, as it's supposed to be. But life afterwards can feel impossible, like a maze that's full of dead ends. Many ex-offenders wind up homeless and jobless. But one ex-offender is going back to jail to share his story of making it on the outside.
How you guys doing?
Good.
Good. Eric brought the cookies.
It's 7:30 in the evening, and about 100 inmates, all of them men, are seated in a large room at the Cass County Jail.
I'm going to kick it off. Who here doesn't know what F5 Project is?
They've come to listen to a guy named Adam Martin, who recently started a company called F5.
The name F5 came from, are you familiar with the keyboard, the F5 function, what it does?
F5 refers to the key on a computer that refreshes web pages. He wants to help offenders do the same thing with their own lives by mentoring them.
Let's say it was they were writing a blog about you, and they were writing felon, left his kids, right? Didn't really leave them, but was locked up. Menace to society, on probation, on parole, right? All that stuff is written about you. When F5 gets hit, all of that is erased. The other reason that F5 is part of the name is that's how many felonies I had when I started the company.
His crimes included stealing, fighting, and breaking and entering. Each time Adam got out of jail, he'd spiral a bit further down into his addictions. He felt he just couldn't survive without drugs and alcohol.
Because by this point, alcoholism isn't a problem. It's literally saving me from committing suicide. If I just get a couple drinks in me, if I get some drugs, right? If I can get some meth, whatever, right? It'll get me motivated to feel like I'm going to take over the world. And all I need is that little bit to get back in my system, and I'll find a job, right? I'll start pounding the phone. I'll start hustling, whatever I got to do to find something.
Eventually, Adam realized that relying on drugs to get his life back wasn't getting him anywhere. He had to kick his habits before he could move forward. So he did. And then he found an employer who was willing to give him a chance at a company called High Point.
And so when I got the job at High Point, I did more in my first year sales revenue than any other sales rep did in their first year.
He realized pretty quickly that he had skills that transferred well to the legitimate world of business.
I had no technology background. I had no sales background, if you will, right, other than serving tables.
But he knew how to talk to people and how to negotiate deals, skills that he says many ex-offenders have. He wants F5 to be that bridge to help ex-offenders find those employers and landlords who will give them a chance.
Hey, guys, my name's Eric Hatch. I have the privilege of owning and running a business, so I have some interesting perspective, I think.
Eric owns Hatch Realty in Fargo. He's one of those employers who has said yes to hiring ex-offenders. He says he understands the challenges many offenders face, also from his own personal experience. Years ago, Eric was a youth pastor. He was also a gambler who wound up in a lot of debt.
Over $70,000 in credit card debt before I came clean. I was working at a job that paid me $28,000 a year.
Eric says he's grateful that he never went to jail. And now he's showing that gratitude by joining Adam in speaking to the inmates. He says he's willing to hire ex-offenders who show a strong desire to work.
If somebody is of the right hunger and the right desire to be better, I certainly would entertain anyone in my world who has a record, because I have a record as well. It just isn't caught by the courts, right? Like I have my sins, my mistakes, my shortcomings, and dang it, if I was held hostage to that, boy, I wouldn't go anywhere.
Eric ends his talk to the men with a message that's part benediction, part pep talk. It's a message he hopes will resonate with the men after he leaves.
So when you come out, what kind of character are you going to come out with? And I hope it's a character to admit your faults, to own your crap, to get rid of that tough fist, to surround yourself with better people, and to make a difference, because that's what you're here for. God bless.
After Adam and Eric's talk, I asked some of the men what they think of the F5 project. One man, who I'll call Mike, sums up the general reaction.
This is a great, great program. I'm going to come next week. That's how good it was my first time. It was awesome, man, that somebody takes the time to come over and at least talk to us about that stuff and is willing to help out.
But it's clear that Mike, along with many of the other men, face huge challenges.
Well, right now I'm currently homeless, so I hate to be that needy person, but I do need help, and I'm glad there's people like this that are willing to help.
As far as what's on the horizon for the F5 project, Adam says he'd like to see it in every jail and prison in North Dakota, South Dakota, and Minnesota.
Well, the F5 project that we just heard about, that's about helping people, somebody who's a former offender and really wants to help people get back on their feet. There's another really interesting way that the legal system has developed try to keep people out of jail, out of prison. And it doesn't sound like it when you hear the name drug court. That sounds like something that would send somebody to jail, but it, right. It's not, right?
Right. No, it isn't. It's for people who, and many of the people who go to drug court are people who have done time in prison, in some cases numerous times. And drug court is an alternative. It's essentially a probation program where the people assigned to it go to court every week, at least initially, to appear before a judge to report on their progress, doing a range of different programmatic things to aid in their recovery from their addiction and getting their lives back on track. So I interviewed one man, Rob Stevens, who had been to prison and then found success and the ability to kick his habit and restart his life by going through the one-year drug court program.
The court is now in session for the East Central Judicial District.
Every Thursday at 4 p.m., the gavel comes down to signal the start of drug court in Fargo, North Dakota.
Well, why don't you tell me what's going on with you?
This week, approximately 20 drug offenders have shown up to report on their efforts to stay clean of drugs and alcohol.
Yeah, I hung out with people I shouldn't have, and I ended up using.
Okay. All right, what's your thoughts on continuing with drug court?
I need to, and I want to, because it's the only thing that's going to keep me in check.
Judge John Irby has presided over this drug court since drug court began in this city back in 2003. He refers to the program as probation on steroids, which is a shorthand way of saying there are a lot of demands made of each drug court participant. Anyone who thinks they can keep using drugs or alcohol and make it through this year-long program is mistaken. Jennifer Hischer is the probation officer who oversees every drug court case.
The amount of contacts and the requirements and obligations that the participants in our program face are much greater than that of an offender who's on a regular supervision caseload.
Jennifer is part of a drug court team that also includes an outpatient addictions counselor, a prosecutor who refers offenders to drug court, and Judge Irby, who presides weekly on the drug court bench in Fargo. There are a total of 5 drug courts in the state's larger cities. Before each week's hearing, Judge Irby gets a report on each offender from the team, so he knows before he even enters the courtroom which offenders are on task and which ones have fallen off the wagon, perhaps because of a failed drug test or not showing up for drug counseling.
For myself, I like to think that I'm there to, for the most part, encourage them to do what they need to be doing.
Judge Irby offers praise and a prize to each offender who has met the week's requirements.
Right. Sounds like you're on your way to a pretty good rebound here. It's a Subway card for you, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
And he sanctions offenders who have fallen off the program, usually with a trip to jail for a couple of days.
We'll let you pick out the nights you can spend in jail, Saturday night and Sunday night, is that correct?
Yeah.
All right, report by 5 o'clock is our usual report time. So, Jennifer, can you arrange that?
Yes.
Okay. 5 o'clock on Saturday.
I have told them at times I can't make you responsible. I can make you miserable. But for the most part, I view my job as trying to encourage them to go out and to comply with the program, to do the best they can, and to turn their lives around.
Turning life around is easier for some than for others. The original intent behind drug court was to treat low-level offenders, usually people caught using drugs, not selling them or committing violent crimes. But that's changed, says Jennifer Hischer.
Today, we're definitely taking a much higher risk, higher need base of offender. A lot of them have very long criminal records. They've been through multiple treatments. Typically, our DUI offenders are all at the felony level, and our drug offenders multiple offenses.
So in some ways, drug courts have become victims of their own success. Completion rates have historically been high, and recidivism rates, meaning offenders who end up back in prison or jail, have been low. Over 70% of people who graduated Judge Irby's drug court in 2014 had clean records still 2 years after graduating. So because of the program's success, the parameters for who is accepted keep expanding.
I've been in and out of prison probably 7 times.
Rob Stevens is a prime example of someone who would never have been referred to the drug court program 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. To say that he has a lengthy crime record would be an understatement.
Probably over a 17-year span of being in and out of prison, I probably had close to 12 and a half, 13 years in.
His addictions included alcohol, pot, and meth. His crimes included drug possession, drug dealing, vandalism, drunk driving, forging checks, burglary, and acts of violence. Along the way, he lost jobs and alienated his friends and family, including his wife, his stepkids, and his father, who he adores. And then, after all of that, he was arrested again.
And this would have been my 8th time back in prison. And I didn't want to go. And I wanted something to change in my life. And I had heard good things about the drug court program.
Rob wanted to change, but he wasn't sure that he could. After all, he'd been addicted to drugs and alcohol for half his life, so he didn't know if he had it in him to quit. He went to his first meeting with Jennifer, the drug court probation officer, full of doubt.
I was nervous, 'cause I didn't feel like I would do very well in the program. It was a very strict program. Requires a lot of commitment, And I've had a history in my life of giving up on things when they got tough.
Jennifer also remembers how depressed Rob seemed at that first meeting.
He was very down. I remember specifically him telling me that he was a loner and meetings would never, AA or any meetings would never work for him. And he was just very negative about his chances for success here.
Why did you think that he was a candidate for drug court, given his record of failure?
Probably because of his record of failure. I mean, this was something that we hadn't tried before, and he was willing to give it a try. And I think, you know, one of the things I like to stress to people is that, you know, I understand it sounds overwhelming and there's nothing easy about this. But in the beginning, all we ask is that you just show up and you try. And he was willing to do that.
Did you think he had the wherewithal to make it through?
I always think that people have the wherewithal to make it through. With Rob, I mean, he had already been to prison. Prison was probably easy for Rob. You know, this was going to be his challenge.
Yeah, one of the things Jennifer said when I met with her was that you were kind of a loner. You didn't really think that other people could help you or make a difference. You weren't really drawn to NA groups and always felt sort of like the outsider. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I could be sitting in a room with 30 people and feel like I'm alone. And it was like that for the longest time.
But Rob was determined to stick with the program. He showed up to all his meetings, his counseling sessions, and drug court hearings. He submitted to frequent and random drug tests. He held down a full-time job and obeyed a nightly curfew. Along the way, he got a lot of support and encouragement from his drug court team and the other people in recovery with him. About halfway through the year-long program, Rob noticed a change.
That's when things really started to click for me with making new friendships in the program and spending a lot of time with a lot of my group mates from drug court and doing things that didn't require anything but myself to have a good time.
Jennifer also noticed the change in Rob's outlook.
I think with Rob, when I had noticed the first real changes in him was when he started connecting with the NA community. He started attending more meetings than we require and doing fellowship activities. He got a really good sponsor, and he just became really enmeshed in that and excited about it, and it was a really good thing for him. You know, and that's one of the big reasons that it's a requirement of this program that they attend a minimum of 2 AA or NA meetings a week. You know, the people that we see succeed are the ones that really embrace that and, you know, continue it long after drug court.
July 28th, 2016 was one of the proudest days of Rob's life. That was the day he graduated from drug court. Everyone who mattered was there. His wife, his stepkids, his friends, and his sponsor. And perhaps most importantly, his father was there.
He stuck by me the whole time. So to have him proud of me is probably one of the most important things to me. And that day he was very proud, very proud.
How do you define happiness for yourself?
Happiness now is family, spending time with family. That's making the people who are close to me proud of what I'm doing today instead of what I was doing 2 years ago.
You can see Rob and his dad together with this story and all the Journeys Through Justice stories online. Just go to news.prairiepublic.org.
Well, on Prairie Public Presents today, I've been talking to Meg Luther Lindholm, who produced this series, Journeys Through Justice, we called it, about some of the different alternatives to incarceration and in the traditional way that the justice system has dealt with people. because of such a challenge of huge growth in the justice system in North Dakota, especially, but all around the country. And I'm curious, Meg, you know, you did all this work on this, mm-hmm. and you talked to legislators, you talked to ex-prisoners and offenders and social workers and the head of the Department of Corrections and so many people. You know, how do you feel about, like, where things are going now?
Well, you know, I what I can say is that I think, you know, the criminal justice system in North Dakota is at a pretty pivotal moment, you know, where there's this turn away from just a focus on incarceration and strong sentences because it's not working, as Leanne Birch has said, and costs are rising. It's to the tune of $41,000 a year per prisoner. And so this is a whole new era opening up here in the state in terms of criminal justice and a change away from just, you know, incarceration towards this other kind of comprehensive programmatic approach within the criminal justice system. We should make clear that, you know, it's not like people are going to be out just, you know, free and clear and just going to treatment. They still will be within the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. It's just many more will be on probation and then getting this more comprehensive array of services that will hopefully help them and help keep the prison population or help reduce the prison population in the state.
Well, of course, one of the people you talked with, as you mentioned, was Leanne Birch, and there was recently an article about her in Mother Jones magazine that people can find online about one of the things you did a story on, her looking at the models in Norway and bringing them here. And because of that article about her, we brought her in on Main Street recently. Doug Hamilton asked her about being in North Dakota and, you know, how intense could we be about making change? And here's what she said.
You know, I would say having to pace ourselves isn't just isn't in a, being in a conservative state. I think you have to pace yourself anytime you're trying to make reforms in a correctional setting. Correction systems are not conducive to change. And frankly, the safety of facilities runs on a very routinized, regular, normal, what to expect type of thing. And I'm very conscientious of that. So you have to take time, I think, is the saying. And sometimes you have to pace yourself. I think we will continue working on what we are working on as far as bringing more of that humanity and dignity into our system, really focusing on how our staff interact with the residents. But I think what's next on my agenda is to really look at what kind of training we're giving to the individuals who work in our system. Right now, I think we have one of the shortest trainings for our staff, and it really needs to be more robust and actually get at some of those philosophical and correctional foundations that are probably not present at this time.
Well, thanks, Meg Luther Lindholm, for being here and talking to us about this whole range of issues having to do with the criminal justice system and how it's working and not working. And I want to give thanks to the North Dakota Humanities Council, too, for supporting this project.
Yes. Well, it's been great. I've really enjoyed revisiting these stories with you. And just to mention that the current issue of On Second Thought, which is the Humanities Council magazine, is devoted to criminal justice issues. And I actually have an article in that that is about drug court in North Dakota, as well as South Dakota and how South Dakota has expanded their drug court system into more rural areas of the state. So I haven't seen it yet, but I think it will be a really interesting issue for anyone interested.
Okay, you could check that out at the North Dakota Humanities Council website, and they would love to send you a copy of On Second Thought as well, I'm sure. Thank you, Meg, and I'm sure this will not be the last we'll hear of this issue.
That's right. Thank you, Bill.